chapter 10 of the book of Joshua. We're starting. Hello. Okay, let's get going here. Now, kind of bring us up to speed here and get us oriented tonight. Last week we studied what is called the Battle of Beth Horon. And that's the battle where the sun stood still. We talked about what is involved in that and what it might mean. And then in verse 15 we read, then Joshua returned with all of Israel to the camp at Gilgal, which you might think means that's the end of the story. And yet the verses we're going to look at tonight give the impression, at least the early verses, that the event that we're going to study here right off the bat happened that very same day. And I think it probably did. So, this incident that we're going to look at seems to take place the same day that Joshua's army crushed the Canaanites in the Battle of Beth Horon, where the sun stood still. So this 15th verse marks the conclusion of one phase of the battle, the main confrontation, the main crushing of the enemy. And now tonight we're going to complete this story and see how the Israelites came into possession of all of the southern part of the land of Canaan. Move on. All right, just a map to remind us. We saw this last week. Here's the Israelite camp at Gilgal. The battle of Beth Horon broke out here near Gibeon. The Israelites chased the Canaanites. This is all downhill. You can't see it on this map. It's all downhill toward Beth Horon. And we take up tonight with an incident that occurred here at Makkedah. And that's where we start our study tonight. Move on, Nathan. So five of these kings, we learned that the southern Canaanite cities all banded together, five of them, there are five of these kings, that they had hidden themselves at some point during the battle in a cave. Now the five kings had fled and hidden in the cave at Makkedah. And so after an unspecified period of time, the Israelites found these kings. I guess, I don't know how they found them, but they found them behind those stones in that cave. And so they go to Joshua, he's down at Gilgal, and report to him what they have discovered. Move on. And Joshua gives the order to seal them up in the cave and leave them there for the time being. Make sure they can't get away. And we need to remember that the kings of the earth, the princes, the generals, the rich, the mighty, and every slave and every free man hid in the caves and among the rocks of the mountains. That's same thing going to happen again. Those that are outside of Christ and those who are hostile to Christ, when he returns, are going to be hiding in the caves, just like the five kings in our lesson tonight. So Joshua said, roll large stones up to the mouth of the cave and post some men there to guard it. So they're going to make sure these five kings can't escape. Move on. The troops, meanwhile, are told to continue to pursue the enemy. That's what makes me think we're talking about the same day as the main battle. Don't stop. Pursue your enemies. Attack them from the rear. Don't let them reach their cities, for the Lord your God has given them into your hand. Why didn't they want to let them reach the cities? Well, the cities are fortified. Their walls, much harder to get to them. Better to defeat them in the open territory than to let them get behind the walls, which would involve loss of a lot of life capturing those cities. So every effort was to be made to prevent these Canaanites from getting back to their walled cities where they would have a certain measure of protection. Now, how long the great campaign in the south lasted, we are not told in the text. We're simply told Joshua and the Israelites destroyed them completely to a man. Only a few were left who reached the fortified city. So they dispatched all the people they could get their hands on. But our historian here tells us there were a few that slipped through their hands and did make it back to their respective cities. Move on. The whole army then returned safely to Joshua. Now Joshua now at this point has moved his headquarters to this Makkedah area outside the cave where these five kings are being guarded. And says no one dared to challenge Israel, even utter a negative word against them in view of these smashing successes that they have experience. Nobody's laughing at Israel now. Maybe there was a time when they did. But God's people now have won a major victory. Now, when they conquered Jericho, I'm sure that some people said, well, you know, there was an earthquake down there or something, and they had inside help. When they defeated Ai, oh, it's just a small town, you know. Well, it's a mighty coalition. We're dealing with a fivefold army. We're dealing with the Canaanites united, and now Joshua has crushed them, and nobody is downplaying or minimizing what Joshua has accomplished at this particular point. Okay, move on. Now Joshua ordered the cave at Makeda opened, the five kings to be brought out, and then our text identifies these five kings, same ones that we named last week, kings of the city of Hebron, note that. Jarmuth, Lachish, note that, and Eglon, okay, Jerusalem, and so there are your five. And then Joshua ordered his captains to perform a ceremony in which they made these captive kings lie down, and Joshua had his commanders come by and put their foot upon the necks of these captured kings. Come and put your feet on the necks of these kings. So they came forward and placed their feet on their necks. Now, why does Joshua do this? Well, several reasons. First of all, this is a symbolic action that signified to the entire army is witnessing this. It signified to the entire army that these enemies and all future enemies that God's people would face are going to be defeated in like manner. This is a ceremony designed to give confidence to Joshua's men, because Joshua knew they still had some big battles yet to fight. This is the end of a phase of the campaign, but not an end of the war. And so he needs to keep his men psyched up and keep them confident because of these future battles that they must fight. Move on. So Joshua said, do not be afraid, do not be discouraged, be strong and courageous. Now what's interesting about those words that Joshua speaks as these captains begin to march by and place their foot upon the neck of these captive kings. What makes this verse interesting is that the last phrase there, be strong and courageous, are words that were spoken to Joshua initially in chapter 1. Spoken to Joshua by Moses, spoken to Joshua by the Lord, spoken to Joshua by the people. And now for the first time, Joshua picks up that phrase. I think be strong and courageous is almost like a slogan that they're using during this campaign to kind of bolster one another's confidence. And so now Joshua picks up on that phrase and directs it toward his commanders as they march by and put their feet upon the necks of these captive kings. So that's what, to me, is interesting. And the fact that he tells them, don't be afraid, don't be discouraged, suggests to me that maybe fear was a factor that Joshua, as the chief and supreme commander here, had to battle all of the time. You've got to keep the morale and the spirit of your troops up. And Joshua here is doing that in this verse. Move on. Now Joshua predicts further victories. This is what the Lord will do to all of the enemies that you are going to fight. Now I like to think about this campaign where these captains put their feet upon the necks of these captive kings and think about something Paul wrote in Romans 16:20 when he says, the God of peace will soon crush Satan under your feet, Christians. The grace of our Lord Jesus be with you. So Paul is telling us that someday we'll be in the same position as these captains and that we will know the complete and final victory over the enemy, although sometimes in the heat of the battle it doesn't appear that that's going to be the case. Someday, Paul says, God's going to crush him under our feet. And I came across a verse just this afternoon in Ephesians where I never looked at it in this light before, where God says that he put everything under Christ's feet when Christ arose from the dead and ascended into heaven. He put all things under his feet. Now that's again the picture and the image of a conqueror, you see. And he has won the victory, and all things are under his feet. Okay, so now here's an actual picture of this ceremony. Here is a happens to be an Assyrian king. Of course, we don't have any pictures of the Israelite. Well, we do have one picture of one Israelite from Bible days. Now, whether you know that or not, there's one person in the Bible of whom we have not a photograph, of course, but a picture on a monument. Does anybody know who that is? One person in the Bible is not very well known. Not David, not Solomon, none of those famous. Now, okay. Well, you're going to learn a little trivia tonight. Jehu, J-E-H-U. His picture appears on an Assyrian monument, bowing down to an Assyrian king. He's the only Bible character of the Old Testament of whom we have, well, the only Bible character, period, that we have a picture of. Anyway, this shows us that the ceremony that we've been studying about and reading about here in Joshua 10 was practiced by all of the armies of that day. And here the king is putting his feet on the back of a captive to symbolize, of course, conquest of that particular nation, whatever it happened to be. So, after being humiliated, these kings having to lie down and perhaps in the posture that we just saw, and having the feet of the captains put upon them, says after being humiliated, they were executed. And notice who did it. Joshua himself struck and killed the kings. Now, it's interesting to me that Joshua never asked his men to do what he wasn't willing to do himself. And so he is the one who executes these five kings. You say, well, what's the justification? Well, they have opposed the march of God's people. They have initiated a battle in which people have died on both sides. They're responsible for this fighting that we've seen here in the last few days. And so they're being punished, and he executes. Move on. They were then impaled. He hung them on five trees, and they were left hanging on the trees until evening. Well, why does he do that? After they're dead, hangs them on five trees. I'll show you a picture in a moment of what that means. Well, this is a symbol that they are cursed. Because in Deuteronomy it says, cursed is everyone who hangs upon a tree. How does that relate to us as Christians? Well, the New Testament refers to the cross as a tree several times. Christ hung upon the cross. He bore the curse, Paul says, for us. Okay? Cursed be anyone who hangs upon a tree. And Christ bore that for us. So hanging them up all day long would be a warning to other Canaanites who would be neighboring towns and villages and people passing by on the highways all day long would see this. And would pass the word and spread the word that the kings of Jerusalem and Hebron and all these other towns were actually conquered and hanging on trees. It was a confidence builder for the Israelites because, as we said before, they have other battles yet to fight. Move on. Now, here's an actual picture from an Assyrian monument of what this involves of hanging them on a tree. I used to read this hanging on a tree and think of the Western movies, you know, with a guy dangling from a rope. Well, it's not that. You can see they put them on a sharp stick like this, and Assyrians would leave people like this around cities that they were trying to intimidate to scare people to death. It would kind of scare you, wouldn't it? Wake up and look out there and see the city council strung up outside your walls. You might decide you'd rather surrender than fight. But in any case, this is the sort of thing that Joshua had done to these kings, and for the reasons that I mentioned, to bolster the confidence of his own troops, intimidate those who are yet to be fought here in the land. Now, at sunset, Joshua gave the order, and they took them down from the trees and threw them into the cave where they had been hiding. Now, the law of God made a stipulation that said that a person who was displayed like this was not to be left up overnight. You had to take the body down at sundown and give it proper burial. And so Joshua here is complying with the law of God as it's stated in Deuteronomy 21:23, as he takes these bodies down and buries them appropriately. Now, I'm not sure technically whether the law in Deuteronomy 21 would apply to non-Israelites, but Joshua, in any case, is following the spirit of the law. Move on. At the mouth of the cave, they placed a large rocks, which are there to this day. So the kings apparently were laid to rest inside this cave where they earlier had taken a refuge, and they pile up these stones. Now, we've been noticing, if you've been with me each week since we've been in Joshua, you have noticed that there have been several major piles of stones that have been erected as monuments throughout the land where significant things have taken place. Now, this is monument number 6. Can anybody name the previous 5? I'm going to show them to you here in a second, but Nathan, don't flip the button quite yet. How many of you can name the 5 previous monuments they threw up? What? One in the river, absolutely correct. That was the first one. Anybody remember the other 4? I'm going to refresh your memory. Move on. Here they are. One in the river, 4-9. Another one at Gilgal, the first camping spot. One in the Valley of Achor over the dead body of Achan who had stolen things from Jericho. One at Mount Ebal was an altar of uncut stones, which you could regard as a pile of stones. And now this one at Makeda. And you've got these 5 monuments that are erected here in the land. Now, what is the significance of that? Why do you think they erected these monuments at these various spots in the land? Okay, Lanny, I think that's right. Or did you all hear him? He says that's an opportunity to tell the stories of how these different significant things had happened to the people of God. When children especially would ask, well, what's this all about? And somebody could explain to them what had happened. Now, let's go deeper than that and understand the significance of monuments. Why do we need monuments?
To remember.
We have some famous monuments in Washington, of course, a number of famous monuments, the latest being, I guess, the Vietnam Wall, and we have the Lincoln Memorial and the Jefferson Memorial and maybe some other lesser ones. What?
World War II
Memorial. In fact, all of the wars, I guess, having a memorial someplace. Do we have any real big memorials around Orlando? I'm trying to think. What do we have? Okay, but nothing that commemorates anything like happened around here. I can't think of anything.
Challenger.
Do we?
Challenger.
Is that over at Kennedy Space?
Yeah.
Okay, I haven't seen that. Okay, I haven't seen that. Well, that's the kind of thing we're talking about. Now, I say that not just to take up time, but to make a point. And that is that in Christ's kingdom, we also have monuments. Now, monuments can be of different nature. You've got these physical stones piled up. That's one kind of monument. But you can also set aside a day. You know, we have the 4th of July to commemorate our independence. We have Memorial Day to commemorate our dead, especially the war dead. We have, well, other special days like that during the year. And these are like monuments to remind us of these kind of things, to bring our minds to focus on these sort of things. Now, in the Lord's kingdom, we also have monuments. There are 3 major monuments in the Lord's kingdom. Can you identify them? No. The cross is a symbol, not a monument. All right, now let's stop there. We got baptism is certainly a monument that reminds us of what? Christ's death, burial, and resurrection. And when we see a baptism, that is what we ought to be thinking about. And also the fact that we once were baptized, it ought to bring back to our memory the day when we were baptized. As we see someone else baptized, it's an opportunity to relive your own commitment to Christ. And then the Lord's Supper, which we still observe every week on Sunday.
What about the church?
Well, the church is not exactly a monument. It is the temple of the Lord. But within the church itself is what we're talking about, monument. And there's one other that I wonder, now Doug's probably going to nail it because probably sometime in the past I've said something about it, and I say something here 6 years ago, Doug still remembers it. The third monument, we've got the Lord's Supper, we've got baptism. What's the third monument? The Lord's Day. And that's the one most people don't get. Because of the attitude of people today is, well, it doesn't matter what day of the week you worship on. I mean, after all, and I keep pointing out to you and hammering away that you can worship every day of the week, and you can meet as a church every day of the week. But the Lord's Day is the official designated day for us to come together and commemorate the resurrection of Christ. That's the official day. Now, if you want to meet all the other 6 days, that's your privilege. But that's the official day. Okay, so let's move on. Now, he goes into the cities here in the south and talks about how they were captured. At this point, the author lists 6 cities in southern Canaan. This is the area where the tribe of Judah eventually is going to settle, and how they were captured by Joshua at this particular point in time. Now, the passage we're about to look at, as you'll see when we go through it, has a lot of similar language and repetition in it. The emphasis in these verses is on how God gave these cities to Israel. He gave them to Israel, but they had to take them at the same time. Is that combination of what God does for us and then what we have to do for ourselves. Move on, Nathan. In each case, they applied the ban, or this harem that I taught you a couple of weeks ago, which is the complete execution of the population. This is under God's orders. In no case did they burn these cities. Why would they not burn these cities after capturing them? Well, for what purpose? They have to have a place to live. Why burn the city and have to turn around and rebuild it? That making sense. So they capture the city and they don't burn it, so that when Judah then takes over this territory, they'll have places to live. They move right into these cities. Now, in the reports of the different, 3 of these cities were mentioned earlier in the chapters, part of the Southern Coalition, and then 3 of them apparently had not been part of the Southern Coalition of Canaanites, but are captured anyway. Certain individual parts of these reports have variations in them because of the different geography involved and the different circumstances. But for the most part, we have a repetitious account of these 6 cities and how they were captured. Move on. Here's an example. Makeda. That day Joshua took Makeda. He put the city and its king to the sword, totally destroyed everyone in it. He left no survivors. He did to the king of Makeda what he had done to the king of Jericho. Libna, 2nd city. Then Joshua and all of Israel with him moved on from Makeda to Libna and attacked it. The Lord also gave that city and its king into Israel's hand. The city and everyone in it, Joshua put to the sword. He left no survivors there, and he did to the king as he had done to the king of Jericho. It's not a repetition there, but emphasis on how God gave it. Lachish. Then Joshua and all of Israel with him moved on from Libna to Lachish. He took up positions against it and attacked it. The Lord handed Lachish over to Israel. There again, what the Lord did. Joshua took it on the 2nd day, 2 days to capture this city. The city and everyone in it he put to the sword, just as he had done to Libna. Meanwhile, Horam, king of Gezer, had come up to help Lachish, but Joshua defeated him and his army until no survivors were left. So here's an example where one of these cities in the south must have had some sort of a treaty with another city, and when it came under attack, the folks who were committed by treaty brought their army up and tried to head off Israel. Didn't do any good. And Joshua was able to defeat both of them. Now notice this. There's no mention here at Lachish of a king. And the reason there's no mention of a king is because he was one of those 5 that got killed there at the cave. So they killed the king there at the cave, but then they went on to capture his city a little bit later. Move on. Eglon. Then Joshua and all Israel with him moved on from Lachish to Eglon. They took up positions against it and attacked it. They captured it the same day and put to the sword and totally destroyed everyone in it, just as they had done at Lachish. Now here again, there's no mention made of the execution of the king. Why? Because he had been killed back in verse 23 at Makeda. He was one of those 5 kings that hid out in the cave. Hebron. Joshua and all Israel with him went up from Eglon to Hebron and attacked it. They took the city, put it to the sword, together with its king, its villages, everyone in it. They left no survivors, just as at Eglon, they totally destroyed it and everyone in it. Now, the city of Hebron the Israelites captured it, but they must not have occupied it. And the reason I say that is because a little bit later, we're going to read that they captured Hebron again. So apparently, they're sweeping through the country, they're capturing the cities, they're executing the population and moving on. At this point, they're not yet ready to occupy these cities. So when the Israelite army moved on, some stragglers and people that had hidden out in the mountains and whatnot would filter back in, occupy the city, so the Israelites had to come back at a later time and capture the city again. Move on. The new king at Hebron, there was a new king that had already been selected in the few days since the old king of Hebron had been killed there at Makeda. They had already replaced him with a new king, and he is executed at Hebron. So I'm suggesting to you that all of this didn't happen in one day. We have a condensed account. It stretched out over a period of time, I would guess maybe several weeks, if not months, in the south. But there's no way to really put a time frame on the events that we're going over. You can see the way the Joshua records this history, that it's condensed. It's a summary of what he was able to accomplish. Move on. Debir. Then Joshua and all Israel with him turned around, attacked Debir. They took the city, its king, its villages, put them to the sword. Everyone in it they totally destroyed, left no survivors. They did to Debir and his king as they had done to Libna and its king and to Hebron. So again, the Israelites must not have actually occupied Debir, because they have to capture the city a little bit later in their conquest efforts. Now, let's get a map here. Let's kind of review, because we've thrown a lot of names of cities that aren't exactly newspaper headline type cities. Now, the camp of Israel's down here at Gilgal in the Jordan Valley, roughly 15 miles up to Gibeon. Here again, our projector's cutting off my words here. I do know how to spell these names, but the distance, you know, if I could pray a wish, I would pray that somehow we would get that projector about half again closer to the screen. It would sure be a big help. They could hang it from the ceiling. Anyway, so they came at Gibeon, where the main battle was fought. They chased the Canaanites down the hills. Here is Makeda, where they executed the five kings. Now, here are these other cities that we've been talking about: Libna, Lachish, Eglon, Hebron, Debir. And you can see they're all just sort of on the same trajectory here, as the army's just moving southward, capturing one city after the other. Move on. So we come to verses 40 to 43, and he gives us a summary of what has happened up to this point in the conquest. It says, Joshua subdued the whole region, including the hill country, the Negev, the western foothills, the mountain slopes, together with all their kings. This is a good verse because it introduces us to the geography of the Promised Land, the Holy Land. And remember how small this land really is. You can put it all between here and Jacksonville and have plenty of room left over. It's only like 100 miles north and south, 60 miles east and west. So we have four natural regions here that had now fallen into the hands of the Israelites. Move on. And they're going to come across the screen here, and then they're going to show up over here on the map. At first he mentions the hill country, which is in this area here, just to the west of the Dead Sea. The foothills are along between the mountain area and the coastal plain. And then the Negev, we're going to talk a good bit about this ice cream cone here that is called the Negev. Because in the modern state of Israel, this ice cream cone, which is semi-arid desert, is a big chunk of the modern state of Israel. They really don't have a lot of territory for their people to live in, because most of it is uninhabitable. Very few people live down here in this Negev, because there's no water. It's just mostly desert. Now, move on, and we'll talk a little bit about that. The hill country and the lowlands, also called the Shephelah in some versions, were mentioned back in chapter 9. The kings of those regions were afraid of Israel. Now we see how Israel has conquered those regions. The Negev means dry area, and it's the region to the south here, and I showed you the ice cream cone, I called it. And the southern border of the Negev merges down into what is called the Sinai Peninsula, toward Mount Sinai. So this ice cream cone is like 4,500 square miles, and it's nearly half the area of the modern state of Israel. So you wonder about the Israelis over there. They don't have a lot of place to live. And, of course, the Arabs keep demanding they give back more territory to the Arabs. I don't know where the Jews are going to live. They keep giving territory back to these Palestinians. Move on. He talks about the slopes or the lowlands that lie between the Judean hills and the plateau region. Now, let's come to verse 40. He left no survivors. He totally destroyed all who breathed, just as the Lord God of Israel had commanded. That's the important part. It's not that Joshua was a particularly bloodthirsty type person. He's under orders from God. The God who gives life can take life. And as I've tried to explain to you on numerous occasions, I keep emphasizing it, these Canaanites had been given 400 years in which to repent. And they had gotten worse and worse and worse. They were one of the most corrupt people ever lived on the face of the earth, and the records will bear that out. We've already learned that whatever Canaanites put their faith in the Lord were spared. The problem is, none of them did except Rahab and her family. So in the light of these, in the light of the verses to follow, when we get into later chapters of the book, it's clear that some of the inhabitants of these cities that we've been talking about did escape. So how are we going to interpret what Joshua says here? Nathan, move on. And what he's trying to say is that they didn't let people deliberately escape. Everybody they got their hands on was executed. But from what we read on in the next couple of chapters of the book, there were a few that did get away, hid out in the mountains or wherever from the Israelites. Now verse 41 gives the dimensions of the conquest. Joshua subdued them from Kadesh Barnea to Gaza and the whole region of Goshen to Gibeon. So we have the terminal points in four directions of the area that now the Israelites have conquered thus far. Now, if the name Kadesh Barnea rings a bell, can anybody tell me why that name rings a bell? No, not Abraham. Kadesh Barnea. That's where Moses took them from Mount Sinai. They went to the original plan was that they would come to Kadesh Barnea and then they would attack the land of Canaan from the south. That was the plan. Well, they got to Kadesh Barnea, and you remember they sent out the spies, and the spies came back and said, no way can we handle that. We'll never be able to defeat those people. They're like giants. And because of that lack of faith, God sentenced them to wander in the wilderness for 40 years. Now, when they came out of the wilderness, they came around the other way and came in from the east across the Jordan River, right in the middle of the land of Canaan. So they've been to Kadesh Barnea before. So in a way, you might say this verse is taking us right back where we were in the book of Numbers, right back to where they were in the days of Moses before they had to wander for 40 years. And now they control all of this territory that they thought originally they could never control. It's now under their control. So this Kadesh Barnea is an oasis out there in the wilderness, what is called the wilderness of Zin, and that's where they'd had their failure of faith 40 years earlier in Numbers 13. Move on. In the west, they'd taken Gaza, which is a Philistine city, or was, or became a Philistine city. In the east, they controlled all the land of Goshen, not to be confused with the region of Goshen down in Egypt, where they once had lived as slaves. In the north, at this point, the northernmost city is Gibeon. Now that's going to change in next week's lesson. But at this point, the northernmost city that they have controlled is Gibeon. Move on. I'll show you a map. Now, I don't know what, I've connected the dots here so you can kind of get a mental picture of where we stand at this particular point. Now, Gilgal is right over here, and you can see they control almost all of the southern region. Now, we'll have a lesson coming up, and I'll show you little pockets here and there that they did not yet control. But for the most part, they control this entire region. I don't know what kind of a figure is that? It's a trapezoid? Is that a trapezoid or almost? Pretty much a trapezoid or parallelogram or something. I don't know what it is. And all of this now lies under the control of Joshua in a very short period of time. How long? I don't know. It took them to conquer all of that. Move on. All of these kings and their lands Joshua conquered in one campaign. One campaign extended over weeks, days, weeks, months, don't know. Because the Lord, the God of Israel, fought for Israel. That's the key. And the author does not boast about the military skills of the Israelite army or the skills of their commanders. He gives the credit to the Lord, as indeed we always ought to do in our spiritual warfare. Again, we're not told how long this campaign lasted. I would say several months. Let's remember that all of the victories in the South had been made possible because God was with them and fought for them. Move on. Then Joshua returned with all of Israel to the camp at Gilgal. So they've been on the march now for several days, weeks, months, fill in the blank, I don't know which. And now they go back to their base camp down at Gilgal near the Jordan River. Okay, that's about it for tonight. I'm ready to sing. Are you ready to sing? Of course we're ready to sing.